Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Quote, I've worked in a lot of countries around the world in the defense attaché system and then in later positions. There is a cost of doing business in certain parts of the world. End quote. Today's conversation is a special two-part series featuring retired Army Sergeant Major Kara Rutter. From her beginning as an Army cook, despite everyone telling her not to take the job, to working in the Secretary of Defense's mess and later serving as part of the defense attaché system in Ukraine, Kenya, and Namibia, Kara brings a unique and strategic perspective to both military service and food systems. In part one of our conversation, Kara walks us through her journey from enlisting in the Army to traveling the world in high-level diplomatic roles. We talk about what it was like to cook for Secretary Rumsfeld, sit as a fly on the wall as strategic decisions played out in the early days of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and see firsthand how global policy is shaped. Kara also shares her transition out of the military and how she and her husband landed on a 20-acre property in Aiken, South Carolina, fencing pastures, collecting, quote, practice animals, and building a new chapter on their farm. This episode sets the stage for a larger conversation about national food security, agritourism, and veteran-led farming. In part two, we'll pick up with Kara's take on using cattle and local food systems to support military bases, and how that led to the founding of Project Victory Gardens and the creation of veteran-focused boot camps and agritourism incubators. For now, settle in for part one with Kara Rutter. It's a story of service and the earliest seeds of something much bigger. Let's get into it.
You know, I'd always kind of been interested in the military. Both my grandfather served in World War II. And so it was, you know, growing up in Montana, it's a pretty patriotic state. And so I'd always kind of had an interest in it. I tried college for a while on an Army ROTC scholarship, and that wasn't really the place for me at the time. So the Army sent me a very nice letter saying that I could provide them with 3 years of my time, or I could pay them back my scholarship money. And so I decided that 3 years of my time was a much better way to go. And so I walked down to the recruiter's office and talked to them. And, you know, when I went in there, I didn't really know all the jobs that the Army offered, but I said, I'm interested in food service. I want to do food service. And my recruiter said, that is the worst job in the Army. You don't want to be a cook. You know, you work weekends, you work holidays. It's the worst job. He said, just go down to MEPS, take the ASVAB, talk to the career counselor, let them show you all the options, and then make a decision. And I said, okay. So I did that, went down, took the ASVAB, did pretty well. So they showed me, you know, signal and MI and medical and all the different options. And I said, what about food service? And the career counselor looked at me and he's like, I can put you in any job in the Army. That is the worst one. You don't want to be a cook. You work weekends and holidays. And I was like, no, that's what I want to do. I want to be a cook. And so I, you know, went to Fort Jackson to basic training and then up to then Fort Lee at the time and became an Army cook and then went off to Fort Hood and worked in the Donning facilities for about 6 years. From Fort Hood and deployed to Iraq right at the very beginning of the war. So in 2003, we were sitting on the border the night the war started. And then when I came back from Iraq, a friend of mine had gotten a position at the Pentagon, in the Secretary of Defense mess. And he called me up and said they were hiring. So I think I got back from Iraq on, you know, the middle of the week, and the next Monday I was up in DC interviewing to take a position at the SecDef mess.
Wow.
And so I was selected for that. And so I spent 3 years cooking for Secretary Rumsfeld in the SecDef mess. And then, once you get that top secret clearance, you can kind of bounce around to other clearance related positions. And so I applied to be part of the defense attaché system. And so I spent 2 years in Ukraine, 2 years in Kenya, and 2 years in Namibia.
Explain that to listeners, even me. I'm not super familiar with what that attaché
Yeah.
role entails.
Yeah, that is the best hidden job in the military. And so it is, it's job immaterial. There's people from all different job fields, whether it's cooks or HR or intel or lots of different positions. They select you based on a whole long list of criteria, but not really because of your job. And so you go and you work in the embassies. So most embassies around the world have a defense attaché office. And so the defense attaché is basically the United States military representative to that country. So you have a lot of bosses. You work, for the ambassador. You also work for, the combatant commander who controls that space. You work for the Defense Intelligence Agency. So you're managing a pretty big portfolio, but ultimately you are the face of the US military to that nation. So you do a lot with, doing aircraft clearances and ship clearances and personnel clearances for all of our military assets that are transiting to or over those countries. And then you do a lot of, meetings and negotiations and things of that nature as well. So, Ukraine and Kenya both had very big offices, but in Namibia there was just two of us. So it was me and a lieutenant colonel, and we'd go to military exercises and do some bilateral training, coordination and things of that nature. So
So you were not doing mess facility work
not
in
at
that
all.
role.
No,
Wow.
nope. Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. Every day is different in a defense attaché office.
No, so how did you even know those opportunities exist? Was it through your time with the at the Pentagon?
I've always been kind of one of those people who likes to make sure I look at all my options, and looked at all of the special programs that were available. And certainly the time at the Pentagon gives you a whole different perspective on, what's available and what's out there, and a lot of obviously, great contacts, and networking opportunities. And it really gives you a different perspective on how the system works, right? I mean, I was a staff sergeant, an E6 at the time I was at the Pentagon. And so, I mean, to be able to sit kind of as a fly on the wall in meetings between Secretary Rumsfeld, while these are the early days of the war, the end of 2003 to 2007. And so to kind of see how some of that works and see how the behind the scenes and the negotiations and those things work, really gives you a different perspective than you would, you'd receive just kind of working on the line somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, no kidding. What was that like? There's lots of questions here, but back to the work with the SecDef mess. Like, what was that like for 3 years working and cooking for this individual, for Rumsfeld?
It's an amazing opportunity. And I obviously have great friends from that time that I'm still really close with, because you're in there kind of on the front lines of diplomacy and policy, and the people that you see and interact and serve on a daily basis. I mean, we would have regular lunches with Vice President Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and Stephen Hadley. I mean, we would see presidents come in and heads of state and foreign ministers, and to be able to sit there and You'd go home and watch the news and see that perspective. But you were in the room, like you saw these things
I
happen.
was going to ask that. Are you allowed to be in that room when those conversations are occurring?
Yeah, I mean, we would be there, like, serving lunches and pouring
Wow.
coffee and
Wow.
I mean, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs would pop into the pantry before, to grab a cup of coffee before a meeting. We interacted with those people on a pretty regular basis, and to kind of see that, you'd see a headline break on the news, and everyone's running around with their hair on fire in the E-ring of the Pentagon. And so that's it definitely provided a really interesting perspective on national policy and foreign policy.
I mean, I was gonna say, as an E6 with a mess background, to be thrust into this huge operational picture and to have sort of firsthand knowledge of what's going on, I mean, how did that shape your look on either the Army or change your interests following that service time or that station in particular?
Yeah, I think that was kind of a big impetus for, for me going into the defense attaché system, because, I wanted to, I wanted to make a difference in the policy and the strategic picture and the operational picture. And I think, it's difficult to go from a position like that and then just to go back, and be a Downey facility manager. Obviously Downey facility managers are the cornerstone of feeding the Army day in and day out. But I felt that, I had a glimpse of kind of this strategic outlook. And so that really carried with me then throughout the rest of my career. So I could kind of, I'd seen the big puzzle, and
Yeah.
so looking at it, from the puzzle piece perspective, it wasn't really a switch that I could just turn off, and
Right.
back to the
It's
tactical level.
that makes sense, right? It's like it's one of those things that once you've seen it, you can't unsee
Right. No, absolutely.
it, right?
Absolutely.
Kenya, Ukraine, and Namibia,
Yes.
right? Those are unique places, one of which is super top of mind now, but of those three, is there some in particular, is there some event that stands out to you? A story, an occurrence from that time with the attaché work?
I mean, there's so many, and as you said, obviously Ukraine is kind of top of everyone's mind right now, and kind of looking at what's happening there. We did a lot of work trying to build up their non-commissioned officer system. So, the NCO Corps is really fundamental to being able to work interoperably with other countries. And so, we've seen that as NATO expands, that has also expanded the role of the non-commissioned officer internationally. And so a strong non-commissioned officer corps is really key to interoperability. That's how, we can communicate at the tactical level with other militaries. And so we did a lot of work with that. And so we During my time there, I mean, we brought out everybody. We brought out the president and the vice president and secretaries and congressional delegations all the time. But I think the most important visit that I was part of in Ukraine was when we brought the Sergeant Major of the Army, Kenneth Preston, to visit Ukraine. And I took him over to Kharkiv. And we went to, the Non-Commissioned Officer Academy, and he spoke there, and we spent several days together in Ukraine and having meetings and talking to the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, because at that time they had a non-commissioned officer corps, but it wasn't really empowered at all like ours is. And so I think that was really important. and having that opportunity to show, to show the Ukrainians that we did that visit, and we did it intentionally, with the sergeant major of the army and myself. We didn't take an officer with us,
Wow.
and so we, we flew over there with the C-12, and went to all the meetings, and there was no officers with us. And that was very intentional to show that, the sergeant major of the army of the United States, came to a country as, a representative of the United States Army, and is conducting, these opportunities and these meetings and these trainings on his own without officer supervision. And I think that was really, that was really important for them to see.
What year was that?
Oh, that would have been 2009, probably 2009, 2010.
All right, so a while, a bit ago now from today, from what you've been able to see in the news or read about how the war is progressing in Ukraine today. Are there any tiebacks that you can, that you're aware of or that you have knowledge of that indicate whether that initiative to empower NCOs worked or didn't work?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I misspoke. It would have been 2007 or 2008. So in 2008, in August of 2008, Russia invaded Georgia. And so our defense attaché office in Georgia, their non-commissioned officer was back in the States on leave. And so I flew over to help kind of cover the office. So, that Russia invaded on Friday night. I flew over Saturday morning,
Wow.
and was there for about a month. And Georgia had been a strong partner with us in Iraq. They had a quarter of their troop strength in Iraq at that time, and we put them on planes and brought them back home. But I think that was kind of, a practice run for Russia, if you will,
Sure.
and to kind of test the waters and see what we would do. At that time, if Russia had invaded Ukraine at that time, I think we would have seen something very different. But between 2007, 2006, maybe that's when we really started, doing some work with the non-commissioned officer corps. And then, up until 3 years ago, when Russia launched a full-scale invasion, obviously, in 2014 when they took Crimea. But they'd invested a lot of time and resources and money into building that non-commissioned officer corps. So when Matt and I were at the Sergeant Major Academy, there's about 50 international students at the Sergeant Major Academy every year. And for a country to decide to send someone to the Sergeant Major Academy, for a year-long course, that's a big commitment. So, we give them, a lot of countries receive kind of sort of a pool of money that they can use to send people to military schools, US military schools. Sending somebody to the Sergeant Major Academy takes a huge chunk of that, because it's a year-long course. It's very resource intensive. And so for them to prioritize that, is really kind of a demonstration of how they view their non-commissioned officer system. And so luckily, when Matt and I were at the academy, there was a Ukrainian student. And so
Got it.
they all have, we assign a US sponsor to all the international students. And so I was, because I'd spent time in Ukraine, I was lucky enough to be able to sponsor Ruslan and really build that relationship with him, and see the growth, from when I got to Ukraine in 2007 until, 2015, 16, when we were at the Sergeant Major Academy. See, the investment that Ukraine had put into establishing a professional non-commissioned officer corps. And I think that that's been key to their success over the last 3 years.
I was just about to ask you that because I know that in the early part of the war, some of the big problems that Russia was having was a lot of their high-level officers and even generals were getting killed in front lines because they really had no ability to lead outside of that capacity. Are you aware of the sort of tactical level success or implementation of NCOs from the Ukrainian military as having a key role in where they are now?
So not really any specifics other than what you see in the news, but so when you look at a military that is conscription based, and most of the world is, really the United States is kind of an anomaly as far as not having any type of conscription, or draft, if you will. A lot of European countries, most of the former Soviet countries, and a good portion of the rest of the world have some type of conscription or mandatory service. It is very difficult to expect a lot out of conscripted soldiers if you don't have a professional non-commissioned officer corps. If you don't have, well-trained junior leaders who are empowered to, to make decisions and look out for the welfare and the well-being of their soldiers. And if we look at Russia, clearly, Russia is conscription-based, very heavily, and has never really invested in a professional non-commissioned officer corps. And I think that's where you see those breakdowns in communication, those morale issues, that have really impeded kind of their ability to maintain, to maintain momentum. As a logistician, I would also say that logistics have obviously been the bane of their existence. And we saw that from the very beginning all the way through, is that they couldn't maintain solid logistics chains. And that's, ultimately, if you don't get the beans and bullets to the front lines, it doesn't matter where the front lines are. Whereas Ukraine, despite the fact that they've obviously had to use conscription, and mandatory service to be able to stay in the fight with Russia, they have, they know what a non-commissioned officer is, and that's key to, kind of keeping that momentum, keeping the soldiers moving forward in the direction that you want them to. You can have great big-brained general officers at the top, but unless you can get their big-brained ideas down to the tactical level and executed, it doesn't matter, what the war plan is if it can't be executed
Interesting.
at the front line.
Yeah, great perspective. And I promise just one more question on Ukraine and then we'll move on. But of the one of the other big rubs right now is the hundreds of billions of dollars that we've sent over there in support over the last few years that arguably some percentage of that is unaccounted for. And the fear is that that has been funneled or disappeared through corruption or other means. Given your experience there, is that ever something that you saw firsthand? Did it ever give you pause then? Does it give you pause now?
So, I've worked in a lot of countries around the world, in the defense attaché system, and then, in later positions. There is a cost to doing business, in certain parts of the world. And there, it when we were in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in any of these countries, there is a certain cost to doing business, that you just kind of have to write off. And I think that we would all like to believe that cost of doing business is not prevalent in the United States systems. But I think if we take a really close look at some of our own systems, there is a certain level of corruption that is kind of baked into all big systems, whether you're talking business or government or military aid or whatever. Is there, graft and corruption across the world? Absolutely. Is it something that we can kind of stand on our high horse and say, we're not going to give you any more money because you can't account for all of this? Well, the Pentagon has never passed an audit.
Correct. Correct.
So, if it's a standard that, we're laying out and expecting everyone who we give aid to, and that is most of the world, gets some type of aid. You look at some of the biggest countries that receive military aid. I mean, you're talking Egypt, Kenya receives a lot. All over the world, there are countries that are receiving vast amounts of US military aid, and there is a certain level of corruption that is baked into that. That's kind of how the world works. It's part of the culture, right? And we can say that we don't accept that. But until our own Pentagon passes an audit, we can't really, we don't have a lot of moral high ground to be able to say that, well, there's no corruption in our system. Obviously, there is.
Baked in the sense that when they were potentially allocating the amount of money to go towards the support, there was, for lack of a better word or phrase, a line item in that allocation amount that was cost of doing business, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's so crazy. Do you think that Ukraine would be where they are without our military support to date?
No. I mean, obviously, the Europeans have certainly done a lot and pulled their fair share. If you kind of look at military expenditures, certainly in Sweden and Finland and along that area, they have Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, they have all increased dramatically over the past several years, their own share of military expenditures. I think we have a duty of care to the world. As the superpower. And this is not new for Russia, right? I mean, it could be argued that it sort of started in 2008 with Georgia, but really their propaganda machine and things of that nature were obviously active much earlier than that. Ukraine has had democratic elections, since the Minsk agreement, where we all said we support your right to be a free and independent country, and we will, if you get rid of the nuclear weapons, then we will ensure your safety moving forward. It was Russia and the United States that said that. So, if Russia is the one that is invading them, then the United States has a duty of care to fulfill our military treaties and our national treaties. And it's expensive. World peace is expensive, but war is much more expensive in different ways.
Yeah,
And
I sorry,
no,
finish.
yeah, no, I was just going to say that there is no winner, looking at it from a purely strategic standpoint, there is no winner in a war with Russia.
Yeah. I think it's a very realistic way to look at that. It's an unfortunate but realistic way that there is a cost of doing this sort of business in international jurisdictions and countries. that isn't always pleasant. Does that change the fact that we shouldn't strive for better accountability? No, I don't think so either. But if you approach it with the sense that our backyard is always clean as well, right? When it's not, I think you're being unrealistic in that course. Okay, so 3 years defense, 3 years defense attaché.
6 years.
6 years. Okay.
Yep.
What next? What happens after that?
So, when I was in Namibia, I was promoted to E8 to Master Sergeant. And so, kind of at that time, it was time for me to go back to the real army. And so, they sent me back to about as real army as you can get, and that's Fort Drum, New York, which is
What is there?
snow, a lot of
Yeah.
snow. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
The 10th Mountain Division.
Got
Um,
it. Okay.
so um, I went to the 10th Cab, the 10th Combat Aviation Brigade. And I was
Okay.
the food service NCO for the 10th Cab. So when I was at Fort Drum for about 18 months, the first half of which, I focused on food service, on, kind of overseeing the dining facility, and, all of the field problems and ordering food and doing that kind of stuff, which I hadn't done in years, almost 10 years by that
Yeah.
time.
Yeah.
And then they decided that I needed some first sergeant time, some leadership time. And so I became first sergeant. I was told that I would not get selected for sergeant major without having first sergeant time. And so the day of my change of responsibility, when I became a first sergeant, my battalion command sergeant major handed me his, or brigade command sergeant major handed me his phone, and he's like, look at this. And it was the pre-position sergeant major list. And I'd been selected without first sergeant time,
Whoa.
which was
Wow.
amazing. And I was like, so are
Wow.
we still doing this?
Yeah.
So I spent about 9 months as a first sergeant, and that was an incredible experience, because the first sergeant role is crucial within the military. That first sergeant, first shirt, whichever service you happen to be in, they're the ones who can really make a difference in people's lives, in a good way or a bad way.
Correct.
And so they're kind of the thing that stands between the soldiers and the leadership, the officers. They're the door that can, help people kind of walk through or shut people out. And so to be able to have that opportunity, and you really see the lives that you impact as a first sergeant. And so that was a great opportunity. And then also, it helped set me up to understand that part of it before I went to the Sergeant Major Academy.
And that was with 10th Cav in the as in and so in that role you were managing all of the food service soldiers.
No, so that was
Oh,
it.
okay.
So I was actually not. I was in a headquarters unit, but it was for
Okay.
the Black Hawk unit.
Oh, wow.
And so
Interesting.
yeah, so
Okay.
we had, I had all the flight ops kids. I also had all of the different shops. So, whether that's the HR shop and the intel folks and the operations folks, kind of all of those specialty things.
Yeah.
But yeah, I actually I don't think I even had any cooks that were in my unit. So it was all focused on making sure the Blackhawks were flying.
No kidding. So 9 months of that before you start your sergeant major time. And what was that like, and where was that? And
So the SAR Major Academy is a year long. It's in El Paso, Texas, and that's
Fun.
it's funny. Fort Bliss is probably the nicest army base that we have.
Boy.
Right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's super nice so that people will stay on base.
Gotcha. Makes sense.
So so the SAR Major Academy is about 500 almost sergeants major from around the army, a few other services, and then about 50 international students. And so we spend a year in the classroom, kind of learning and developing. It's actually where Matt and I met, so
Oh,
that was the best thing that came out of the SAR Major Academy.
fantastic.
But yeah, that was a great experience. And then we graduated in June of, goodness sakes, 2016.
Okay.
And then I went to Washington State to join base Lewis McChord. And Matt went to Stuttgart, and
Oh, wow. Wow.
I'm sorry, Wiesbaden. And so we did that for about a year, and then we got married in 2017, and then we both ended up in and around South Carolina. So Matt was stationed at Fort Eisenhower now, was Fort Gordon then, and I was at Shaw Air Force Base in Sumter. And so
Okay.
we kind of split the difference geographically and lived in Aiken, South Carolina for our last 3 years.
Was the role that you were at for a year in Washington State?
So I was the 7th Infantry Division Food Service Sergeant Major.
Okay. What and where? You said a name that sounded somewhat familiar, but I couldn't
Yeah,
cover that officially.
so Fort Lewis, Joint Base Lewis
Fort
McChord.
Lewis. That's right. Okay. Yeah, those. I know that in the Marine Corps, when you've got husband and wife, spouses that are both active duty military, they try to get them in at least the same coast, but it sounds like in that situation it didn't work.
Well, and so once you get up to the SAR major level, there's only 3,000 sergeants major in
I
the
gotcha.
entire army.
Gotcha.
And so when you get, kind of when you get to that level, most of those programs go out the window,
Understood.
which is why we retired when we did.
Okay.
They were calling and asking where we wanted to go next, and there was only about two options in the entire world where we could go and be at the same place, and neither one of them sounded very attractive. So
Okay.
we said, no, I think we're done with this. I think when we moved to Aiken, we found a beautiful 20-acre property with a pond, and I went TDY to Qatar, and when I got back, I had ducklings floating in the jacuzzi bathtub and baby chicks in the laundry room because Matt had gone to Tractor Supply, and he said, surprise, we're farmers.
Aiken, Georgia?
Aiken, South Carolina,
Aiken, South Carolina. Okay.
just on the South Carolina side from Augusta.
And how did you guys realize that this was a place that were you just looking for land and it happened that this one was available?
So if you draw a line between Augusta, Georgia, and Sumter, South Carolina,
Okay.
there's a lot of nothing between there.
Fair.
And so my daughter was in high school. We needed a place with good schools, and so
I
we really
gotcha.
liked the look of Aiken. Aiken's a really neat place. It's a big equestrian town, so it's
Okay.
where kind of the Saratoga set back in the day used to bring their horses down during the winter. And so there's steeplechases and fox hunting and all of
Wow.
the different equestrian events. The World Equestrian Team, the American team for the World Equestrian Cup, usually trains there. And so it's kind of a neat place. And so we looked at a lot of properties. And finally drove into this property, and it was a weird place. It was a a duplex on 20 acres.
Interesting.
But we didn't even walk into the house, and Matt's like, yep, this is the one. I mean, the property was great. Yeah. Like a 3-acre pond, and so just beautiful.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Kara Rutter. From her early days insisting on becoming an Army cook, to serving in the Secretary of Defense's mess, and working inside embassies across the globe, Kara's path is anything but typical. Kara shows us how pursuing what feels right, even when it defies convention, can lead to doors you never expected to open, from the Pentagon to international diplomacy. Her transition out of the military reminds us that while leaving service can feel like a loss of mission, sometimes building fences, literally and figuratively, can be the start of something entirely new. If Kara's story resonated with you and you'd like to learn more, you can connect with her directly through Project Victory Gardens or reach out via LinkedIn. Be sure to join us for part two, where we pick up Kara's thoughts on strengthening food systems for military bases, the roots of Project Victory Garden, and her work building the next generation of veteran-led farmers. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Bassa, and until next time, stay frosty.